about Sam. So next time, I'll make sure that you have those. So thank you for tolerating the sticky name tags today. All right, let's start with some introductions. We'll just go around the table. We'll start with the table, and then we'll go around the perimeter. So I'm Tanya Carlone. I'm a facilitator with the Consensus Building Institute.
Kelly, I'm Kelly Peterson with Duke County. I'm Shirley Chastain, the Consensus and Building Manager at GC.
James Burke.
Samantha Lewis.
Bruce Smith.
Gary Cole.
Greg Saunders.
Dave Keene.
Pat Dawson.
Jeff Carter, German Irrigation District.
Joshua Pierce.
Chris Madden, New Point Community College District.
Fantastic. And then we'll go around the perimeter.
Tracy Novak, New County.
Paul Dawson, New County.
John Lake.
Nice to have you. All right. Good to see you all. Thank you for being here. I know we're just getting in the groove. This is our, let me get to the agenda. This is our second meeting of the VINA Stakeholder Advisory Committee. And the first one of 2020. Hi, welcome. And Linda's been working really hard for us this morning. We just did introductions. More packed here. Yeah, Linda, the City of Chico hosting the event, and thank you for all the work that you've done this morning. Okay, let's take a look at the agenda, and then we will go from there. We've got a lot of really interesting things to cover today, I think. After I do the agenda review, we will take a look at the action minutes from last time and see if we have any amendments to those meeting notes before we finalize them. You know that we are a Brown Act compliance committee here, and so the agenda is designed in that way. And so then we will check in to see if there's any comments from the public for items not on the agenda. We're going to revisit what we started to discuss last time, which was on December 17th. You'll recall that we reviewed our charter, so we understand what the purpose and roles and responsibility are for this committee. And there were a couple of changes that you suggested, and we have integrated those, and we'll see if you're ready to send it up to the VINA GSA Board of Directors. We'll just do an overview of the Brown Act compliance so that you as committee members and members of the public understand sort of those operating principles that the California law requires for a committee such as this. And we'll take a look at the Stakeholder Communications Engagement Plan for the VINA sub-basin. It has been approved by the GSA, and we're interested in you being aware of it and seeing what comments you may have. At the end of each of these agenda items, I will turn to the public after the advisory committee has had the full, robust discussion you'd like to have, and then I will turn to the public to see if you have any comments or questions about those items. Then we will move into pretty exciting, the first chapter of the TFP draft chapter, to see if you have any, if the committee has any comments or questions about refinements for that chapter. And, before we do that, I'm sorry, Christina Buck with the county will give us a background on basin setting, the basin setting components of the GSP. Then Kelly will lead us through that draft monitoring protocols for data collection and monitoring chapter. And then Paul Goslin from the county is here to have a discussion with all of you about the VINA out-of-basin transfer rule, the process, the draft process, and he'll talk more about that. And then we will wrap it up. So that's what we've got. You recall last time we had a two-hour meeting. We said that run the full 3 hours, and when we put the agenda together this time, we realized that we did need the full from 9 to noon. Just to be aware, in the future, when we put together the agenda, we find that it doesn't require the full 3 hours. It would start at 10 and would go from 10 to noon. Okay, but keep it on your calendar as 9 to noon for the time being. Any questions for clarification about the agenda? Okay. And before I go to approval of the last meeting minutes from 12:17, I just want to turn to the public to see if you have any comments for items that do not appear on today's agenda. And you'll just note there that we do ask for any comments to be within 3 minutes, please. And since we do have a lot on the agenda, and also realize that you'll have an opportunity to make any remarks for topics that are on the agenda. So any comments for anything that's not on today's agenda? Okay, thank you. Chat members, let's go ahead and look at the meeting summary from last time. You'll notice that these are high-level meeting briefs. However, we will not finalize them until we bring them to you, like I'm doing today. This is the first time you're looking at them. So do you have any suggested changes or refinements to the minutes from last time?
Move to approve minutes.
Yes, so we will just do that generally by consensus, so it sounds like there are no comments. And so we will go ahead and remove the draft watermark, and these will be considered final, and we will post them to the website. Okay? All right. let's look at the charter. You remember last time, I know it was right before before our break, and we discussed the draft charter. Now, the charter needs to be approved by the VINA GSA Board of Directors. But we want to make sure that we have sort of consensus agreement among the SHAC members before we send that up to them. Last time, you made a couple of suggestions, and I have highlighted them here. So under the member, the SHAC Advisory Committee member terms, you can see this highlighted section, which is where there's been a change. So last time it just read that SHAC members serve at the will of the Groundwater Sustainability Agency Board and may be removed by the board with or without cause upon a supermajority vote by the board. We added this section, this next bit of text, that SHAC members may also be removed from the committee for failure to attend 3 consecutive meetings unless there are extenuating circumstances as determined by the GSA board. And we agreed last time that we felt it was important for there to be, just given the technical nature of our work, that missing 3 months of meetings would really be difficult. So that's, was an inclusion, and is that consistent with what we discussed last time? Does anyone feel that that's inconsistent with what we discussed last time? Okay. And then there was a suggestion for under process agreement on page 5 that we just add a bit, and I noticed in your copy when I went and read over this, it said something like, instead of in, it said home. But I've made that correction. So everyone agrees that members can meet with other organizational or interest group members in accordance with the Brown Act. And that's all we added to that. Again, put a fine point that, and we're going to talk a little bit about Brown Act compliance today, but we want to make sure that that was explicit here. And that was the only other addition. Okay, so with those two changes, I think, based on the conversation we had last time, that we're ready to have the committee send this up to the VINA GSA board. Is there any discussion? James?
We're going to know who's on the management committee.
Oh, who is on the management committee?
The management committee is tasked with setting the agenda and other, they have other responsibilities as well. That's one of the main responsibilities.
Yes.
Yes,
the management committee, but you're asking for specifically who is on that committee. Yes, so currently there is a representative from, at least one representative from each of the VINA GSA member agencies. So I'll let each of you speak from Durham Irrigation District, who sits on the management committee.
Tammy Lozer is the primary person sitting on it. She has a conflict this morning and will be tagging my hand, signaling for me to leave. I'm the attorney for Durham Irrigation District, and I set as a secondary member on it.
Mm-hmm. So that's Tammy. And then for the city of Chico?
Yeah, I'm Linda Herman. So we have two members. We have myself and then also the public works director, Eric Gustin, operations improvements. And I'm the park and natural resource manager.
We'll make sure that these are in the notes so that you have documentation of it. And then for Butte County?
Yeah, so Kelly Peterson, water resource scientist for Butte County. I'm on the management committee for the VINA GSA board.
Paul?
Paul Goss from Butte County. Kelly is the principal, and so could I sit in and just fit in?
And then in addition, we have Colin Kleinsteiger from the Wichita tribe here locally. So he is always involved in our discussions and when we set agendas, and there's a group discussion of that. So that's your right at GSA. And I think that's on the website too, just in case you want to have that.
Okay, thank you for the question. All right, any other discussion before we approve this draft charter and send it up to the VINA GSA board for approval? Okay, not hearing any further conversation or any objection. We will, the management committee will include this in their staff report at the next VINA GSA meeting, and we will look to the board for to finalize this. Once it's finalized, we'll make sure that we let you know that, and then it will appear on the website. All right. Thank you all. Okay, let's talk a little bit, this is the nuts and bolts stuff, as we're still getting set up. Let's talk a little bit about Brown Act compliance. This very short presentation, which is basically a distillation of information that came from one of these links that we sent to you, that's on the agenda. I mean, if there are those among you who were so into the Brown Act, perhaps you read the California Attorney General's publication, which was the long version, and I actually took this information from that second link, which is the First Amendment Coalition.org. And it's really just to help us understand sort of what the law requires of all of us, of all of you, and of the agency that has brought you together, and for members of the public so they know what to expect. This information will be included on the website. It did not go out ahead of time. But the information did, but not in this form of my presentation. So just a quick overview. As it says here, the Brown Act, Ralph M. Brown Act, and there is the government code listed there, is intended to provide public access to meetings of California local agencies. And I just thought it was useful to pull this quotation out of the code as to the purpose. And that is that the people of the state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. The people in delegating authority do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them, what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. And so that's the intent of the Brown Act. Sometimes I think we get sort of focused on the weeds of somebody drew out a notification, da 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 da, and it's important to just step back and say, well, why are we even under these laws? And that's the intent. Let me actually put this into slide view so it's bigger. Can you see it back there? Okay, great. So who's subject to the Brown Act? I pulled out those parts that really just apply to you. Because that's what I think is relevant. So why the SHAC is subject to the Brown Act is that it's a commission, committee, board, or other body of a local agency created by charter or formal action of a legislative body. So you were formed by a formal action of the VINA Groundwater Sustainability Agency, which is a new agency, right, that formed to govern over groundwater in this basin in association with somebody we can't forget that there is one other groundwater sustainability agency in this basin, and that is Rock Creek Reclamation District. And I believe, Paul, if I could just stop here for a second, that when you have a memorandum of understanding with them, I'm sure you would just share that with the SHAC.
Sure.
Yeah. And that's in progress, right? It goes to discussion. Okay. So you are a committee that has been formed by charter and formal action by that legislative body, the VINA GSA, and that's why you were subject to the Brown Act. There's a lot of text on this, but I'm just going to point to the most important pieces. So advance notice of meetings must be provided under this act, and it specifies that regular meetings, of which this is one, and we know that we have a published schedule for the first 6 months of your meeting. For these regular meetings, there must be notice through the posting of an agenda at least 72 hours before the meeting. So you'll notice what we do. Well, we send the materials directly to you, and then we immediately thereafter post them to the website. And then the county sends out an e-newsletter to the interested parties list in at least 72 hours before. We try to have it be a little bit more than that, but 72 hours is the requirement. If for some reason there's a special meeting that is called, there needs to be 24 hours notice to each of the local newspapers. And the notice must be posted in a location that is accessible to the public. There is a possibility of having emergency meetings. You know, it's hard for me to imagine facilitating a lot of these advisory committee meetings that there would be such an emergency that would occur for the advisory committee, but there is a provision in place. And if there's some drastic circumstance, then just 1 hour notification to media outlets is necessary. But for our purposes, really, we're looking at this 72 hour notice is how we're generally going to operate. Any questions on that notification? Okay. You'll notice that the agendas really there is a description of what the intent is or the objective is for each of the agenda items, and that is required by the law. And as it says there, quotations from the code, is that the purpose of the brief description is to inform interested members of the public about the subject matter under consideration so that they can determine whether to monitor or participate in the meeting of this body. And it is very clear that agenda descriptions cannot be misleading, right? It does need to be to the point and accurate. Further agenda requirements, the Act states that no action can be taken on items not on the agenda. So one of the things that we do, even though in the last two meetings nobody has brought up comments about things that are not on the agenda, but it is a provision of the Brown Act that you need to open it up to the public and say, do you have comments on anything relevant to this body that's not on the agenda? And then let's say somebody does, we can't take action on anything because that would need to be publicly noticed. So all that is allowed for items not on the agenda are brief responses to public testimony, requests for clarification from or references of matters to staff, brief reports, you know, on updates or personal activities, and obviously when there is an emergency meeting, that sometimes the agenda is just being brought to that meeting and it hasn't been notified. And when two-thirds of the legislative body agree that there's a need to take immediate action on a matter. That wouldn't apply to the SHAC. The legislative body that you're under is the Vine and GSA board. Any questions about that bit? Okay, as it says here, time must be provided for comments by the public. And as we've done, we can impose time limitations, and that's just to make sure that we stay on target with our agenda. And as it says there, the public may comment on agenda items before and during consideration of this body. And time has to be set aside for public comment on any other matters under your jurisdiction. So how we handle that is that for each of these agenda topics, these items, we will go to the public after the SHAC discusses them. Okay, now, this is a funny thing. You might think, oh, this is so self-evident, what constitutes a meeting. But it actually is a little bit tricky. What constitutes a meeting includes any congregation of a majority of a legislative body at the same time and place to hear, discuss, or deliberate on any matter within the jurisdiction of the body. There's been some legislation, I mean, some litigation on Brown Act violations that have to do, I think, specifically with this notion of serial meetings, which can occur either in person or by telephone or other electronic means, where there are even go-betweens that constitutes a meeting. So an example of this is if I were to go around as the facilitator and sort of independently poll you, all of you, on something that's come up in between the meeting where I want to sort of get the collective concurrence on an action, and that hasn't happened in public. And I'm doing it just person to person, because any two of you would be able to talk with one another. But if I'm going to each of you and getting a poll, and then we're making an action that way, that could be seen as a violation of the Brown Act. So that's where there's been some litigation, and so I just wanted to bring up serial meetings. I don't expect that this is going to be an issue at all with this advisory committee, but I just wanted to bring that up. I just want to stop here and go to the staff if you have any comments on anything that I've said so far related to. Okay, just want to make sure it's clear since you live and breathe Brown Act, right? a little bit more about what's defined as a meeting. These things are exempt from a definition of a meeting. Individual contacts or conversations, you are free to talk to one another. Attendance of you can all, or a majority of you could attend a conference that is open to the public that involves a discussion of general interest, provided that you do not discuss legislative business, right? So it's, you can go to any meeting that has been publicized or has been put on by someone else, any conference, but you're not actually sort of getting together and coming to any sort of decision about the proceedings of this group. And this is all, I don't want to go into all of this, it's any ceremonial or social event, any community meeting, any conference, you know, you can go to those. And then the last one is attendance of a majority of the members of a legislative body at an open and notice meeting of a standing committee of that body, provided that the members of the legislative body who are not members of the standing committee attend only as observers. So I know that this can be, maybe this is a little bit too much detail, but it's, I think, important for you to just have this background. Any comments from staff about these definitions of what's exempt from the definition of a meeting?
Quick comment on that. So, say all of our CHAC members attended a 9HGSA board meeting and discussed topics of the CHAC at that meeting. That would be a conflict of...
No, they would be doing that in public.
Right, so that's a public meeting, so that's...
Yes.
Okay, so as long as they're addressing things that are on the agenda of the 9HGSA board.
And that, and their comments are appearing in public.
Yeah.
It's not as if they're then going off into a closed meeting in an adjacent, you know, conference room, deliberating over something that has been discussed, sure. Right, at the 9HGSA meeting, and then sort of coming to their own decisions
outside of the public
view. That's a great example, because that may happen,
sure.
Right?
Exactly.
And we might actually really like for that to happen, let's say, for...
But it needs to be on the agenda, so, and it needs to be part of what the report would be back to them, because they aren't just the advisory, but not the governing body, so... But it has to be whatever there is on the agenda that they're coming to speak about. Usually it'd be a report from the committee or the chair of the committee or the task force or whatever. Where it gets a little trickier is if we have alternates on the board attending the meetings, that's when they just need to be observers and not on paper, like on the general board. So
yeah.
We have our primary and then the alternates, they just need to make sure that they...
You mean the GSA boards?
Yes.
Yes. But for staff members, I think that is a really important nuance that you just brought up, right? You would all be able to attend and to speak as long as it is on the agenda, right? Okay, questions about this from the CHAC members?
There's quite a bit of overlap amongst groundwater users. I represent that, but I also have domestic wells, so technically I'm also a domestic well user. And all farmers are stewards of the environment. So if you add up 3 ag reps and 2 domestic well reps and an environmental rep, you've just exceeded the majority. And if we all decide to have a meeting with our constituents, we're getting kind of sticky here. What do you suggest?
Give me that scenario.
Well, we're supposed to be representing these types of users, and to get their feedback, we are tasked with the responsibility of communicating and getting their input.
Mm-hmm.
So, Greg, Gary, and I have a meeting. Well, the domestic people are going to want to show up too, because I'm a domestic well user. I would want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jim would want to be there. Probably first too. So now we've just exceeded the majority and are in violation of the Brown Act. What do you suggest?
Yeah. Staff, I'll look to you for some guidance on that.
Yeah, I don't think there's an issue if you individually want to go talk to situation with people in the community. If you start, if you think about it, start your scenario, start setting up a meeting with this one or more of you and others may come. Really what you're doing is you're setting up a shack meeting that needs to be noticed. So if those topics need to come in, it would be maybe agendizing or setting it up when you wanted to have that meeting with constituents, but agendize it so all those discussions can be held in public and have all committee members there.
So there are a couple of options that you could either say that there is this issue of real importance that we feel like for us to be real ambassadors to do our job to represent our constituents is to have a forum. We could agendize that at this meeting. However, it does occur from 9 to noon in the on a weekday, which is not convenient for a lot of people who have jobs from 9 to 5. So then we might decide that is a conversation that should happen at a public workshop, for example. And then we would have it agendized where maybe SHAC members would be leading that discussion or have an active role. But those would be two opportunities to do that where you feel like really we're starting to have a situation where it would be beneficial for more than a majority of us to be able to speak with our constituents at the same time. Then those would be two options to do that.
So my understanding of Bronx is that you can have like basically subcommittees or ad hoc committees, and as long as you're creating a space so that the public are aware that this meeting is taking place and that they have the opportunity to participate and contribute. So if you know you're going to have a meeting where potentially several SHAC members would be attending, it could be just have that agenda posted at least 72 hours in advance to the SHAC website that the public has been notified that this meeting is taking place. Here are the items that were going to be discussed in case anybody would like to participate. And then you just have to have minutes, and then as minutes are captured as part of public record.
But as long as you're not representing a majority, so subcommittees are typically not a majority of members, so it has to be less than the 6 members to do that.
And those are set up by vote of the committee to form a subcommittee.
Yeah.
So you just can't go off on your own and start holding your own meetings under the CEDAR.
Less than the majority.
Because if you're setting up a subcommittee or an ad hoc committee, that has to be decided here to set up. So
it actually should be decided by the board, too. The GSA board, because all you are advisory to the board, not you really don't make decisions. I know it doesn't sound good, but it's really the board that makes decisions. You advise the board, so really the board would have to direct you to do something that's technically.
Well, you make recommendations. If you feel that it's important for you to form a subcommittee for a particular purpose, then we would capture that in this meeting, and that could be taken through the management committee up to the minor GSA board. That recommendation. You are free to individually talk to as many constituents as you would like. When we start to get into something that would look like a subcommittee having a meeting, we would want to bring it here and do what we just said. If we feel that it's important for a majority to be a part of it, we have the two options that I mentioned, having a forum at a discussion at this meeting, having that agenda as a public workshop, and there will be some of those that take place. And if there was something that was really important that a majority of you felt was necessary, that it would be possible that where you felt it was time sensitive and needed to occur before the next regular meeting, then we could potentially call a special meeting. I mean, that's a possibility as well.
Okay, so just to follow up, who exactly do we contact? Because this is not a traditional setup where there's a chairman of the board.
You contact me.
Gotcha.
As a facilitator. Yes.
And just not to belabor the point, but we just did a brown victim. And so this will be repeat for you, Sheree. But one of the things I think are good examples, so there's two ways to be a serial meeting, and it's called a daisy chain. So one person talks to one person, who talks to the other person, who talks to the other person. And then there's also the one that I think people don't think of too much, is the spoke in a wheel. So if you go, say, for the chair, if you did have a chair,
that person spoke to that chair, and then that chair spoke to another person, then went to another person, went to another person, went to another person, that too is considered a servant meeting.
So yeah, that was the example that I gave you of I went and talked. That would be sort of the hub, you know. The serial meetings, that's why I called that one out.
Serial.
Thank you for putting a finer point on that, because I didn't mention the daisy chain thing. Yes, please.
Just, I guess, along the same lines, too. So Tanya, you send out email about agendas, about et cetera, to the entire list, and so we're all on a list together. Now, if, say, we'll say Anne. Say Anne says reply to all.
You can't.
So say she says reply to all, and she writes an email to everybody else on the list. Is that a violation of grammar?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing this up.
So you want a blind copy. That's why a lot of times you want a blind copy of the commission, mm-hmm. because that way they can't reply.
I just didn't know if everybody sort of knew that, so I wanted to...
Sorry, you're talking about that. But that's what we do, is we blind copy so that it's not accidentally reply all.
Yeah.
Because once you start that conversation, it's
right.
It's serial meeting.
Exactly.
Okay.
We have to be really careful with everybody's stuff.
That's great. Thank you, Kelly, for bringing that up. And I'll make sure to blind copy going forward. Yes. So then the blind copy takes care of that accidental copy all. Right now, the way I sent them out is a full distribution list. I have, and you wouldn't, under those circumstances, want to reply all.
It's just a safety precaution.
Okay.
That's not to say that we can't email each other. The email just has to go through staff. So if, say, for example, I have something that I want to share with the entire shack, I need to email staff, and then staff can send to the entire group. So we can still communicate with each other. It just has to go through staff.
Yeah, and in this case, that's me as the neutral facilitator, you know, under contract. Okay. These are really good examples. Thank you. Anything else on that before I talk before I talk about a few other requirements? Thanks for bringing that up, Samantha. That was really important. Okay, the meetings must be held within the boundaries of the agency's jurisdiction. That's why none of these meetings for the Vinus sub-basin can occur at the county facilities, because that's in the Wyandotte Creek sub-basin in a different jurisdiction. As it says, your regular meetings must be held in a time, place, and location fixed. We are intending to keep them here. If that has to change, it will be a part of the 72-hour meeting. If it gets very specific, the Brown Act, if something occurs, some disaster, let's say, some safe community designated place, the new location must be publicized by notice. And the meeting place must be accessible to all members. So is there a...
There's an elevator.
There's an elevator. Okay, and then there's the back entrance. And then do we...
That should be unlocked.
That should be unlocked. I noticed.
That we unlocked that.
Yeah, make sure that we unlock that. I checked it was early when I came at 8:15, it was locked, the accessible, ADA accessible entrance. No fees can be charged for admission to any of the meetings. This is important for members of the public to know that members of the public can sign in if they would like, but they are under no obligation to do so. Registration is not required. And cameras, it's important for all of you to know this, right? Cameras, both still and video and tape recorders, are permitted. And any recording of this meeting made at the direction of the public body is public record. So if there was something that was really, that the agency felt like, oh gosh, we're having a guest speaker, let's say, where it would be really helpful for the public to just be able to go back and listen to that. That would need to be posted to the website, and it becomes considered a public record and can be subject to the Public Records Act for any request for a public record. And the public bodies must permit a broadcast of their meetings unless they can demonstrate that doing so would cause a persistent disruption. Okay, somebody can come at me here and live stream. You know, it's important for you all to know that. I've been a part of some pretty contentious public meetings where literally members of the public who are videotaping come and like attach microphones to me, you know, and which is a bit intrusive, and I don't make a big deal about it, and you know, I ask them to ask for permission, but when I'm representing agencies, it's a sensitive issue, and almost all of that is permitted, and especially some of these very controversial meetings that I've been a part of. So just so you know that. Anything about that recording?
And then I mentioned that we do record these. We have audio recordings of these meetings so that they are open to the public if there's a request.
Are you recording it?
Yes. Okay, right there.
Good to know.
You didn't see her put the microphone on.
Yeah, I know. Thank you for allowing me my great good bubble, okay? And I guess I just recorded what I just said. Okay. Public records that I just mentioned, records distributed at a public meeting are public records. Okay, all of these materials that you've received are subject to public records act. And the public is entitled to obtain them at the meeting if they were prepared by the public agency. And like this presentation that was not prepared by the agency will be posted to the website after. That's an example of what's happened here. So it says that if materials are prepared by someone other than the public agency, they need to be provided to the public after the event. Any questions or comments on that?
How can the audio recordings be accessed by the public? Where are they? Are they online?
They are actually housed in our Butte County office, and so just a request for that. That's all you need to do. So you can send that to Tanya, and then she'll contact us for that.
Any other questions or comments? Is some of this surprising to any of the chat members? Okay.
How many members on the committee?
10.
So I was under the impression you couldn't meet with a majority, so 6 would be too many, 5 would be okay. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
The caution with that is if you talk to one other person,
yes.
It's just you don't know necessarily they may talk to another person. And you don't know if they talk to another person, then you could get into the whole serial meeting. So you're at a meeting with 4 or 5, you're really standing on the edge of potential Brown Act violation if any one of you makes mention of the topic to another member. So all of that too, it gets back that really the whole point of this is your deliberations should be in the public setting or the public invite. And as frustrating and inefficient as that may be, there's a lot of good importance to that. It does kind of make you put the brakes on, things you might want to otherwise talk about to make sure that you wait to have all those deliberations here and you can engage with that with your colleagues.
And there's the letter of the law, basically, and then there's perception, too. So you always want to, even if the public perceived that you were violating the Brown Act, you just have to be cautious of trying to talk to people about outside of public. So that's also, you're always under scrutiny. That as well as perception, not just the law.
Okay. So, how long would those limits, not talking to the now, I mean someone on the street that I...
I think generally, as long as the issue is still something that might come before here or the board, you know, I think as long as the item is still alive, it comes into play. Because you think about it, the public would want to know that you haven't done things behind closed doors, you know. And that sometimes those things don't occur for months by the time they get up and be decided or the deliberations here.
So it might be a good discussion about ex parte communication, you think, Tom, there?
We'll go ahead and bring up the community.
Well, there's also the ex parte communication that if you do talk to somebody, you have to divulge that you spoke to that person as well about the topic that's going to be on there. That's usually part of the general too. So that is part of the law also that you need to notify that you have had this conversation about something that's going to be agenda in before the meeting or in part of the meeting. So, and I don't know if it's on the stakeholder level, but it's definitely on the board level for sure.
I'm not trying to be ridiculous here, but say I talk to Bruce at someone else today, and then I talk to another person the next day, and another person the next day. I'm not bringing together the group or a group. I'm talking to individuals one-on-one. Does this same rule apply that I just should not be communicating around the table?
That's called a daisy chain.
Yeah.
Or the hub and spoke, right?
Yes.
In this condition, he's got the one talking to individual people and a majority of those, and that would be...
You would become the hub of the
So the ex parte, let me ask, again, I'm asking particularly staff on this since you do a lot of this work. Do you think it would be beneficial to include disclosures on the there are some committees that I work with that are Brown Act that have disclosures as part of their standing agenda?
Is that hilarious?
Usually they'll announce at the beginning of the meeting that they've had this discussion, the ex parte. Again, I can go back and look. I don't know, you know, because, and maybe Jeff can help us on here, but, you know, this is a stakeholder, which is an advisory to the board. Definitely on the board level, we should have disclosures. I don't know how it fits in with the stakeholder group. Do you know?
You don't need to have an ex parte communication on the agenda. If it comes up during the course of a discussion that one member of the committee or the board has had a discussion with another person involving it, it's generally advisable for that person to disclose that. And for fear of dissuading you from continuing on membership here, it mandates that the public's business needs to be conducted in public. You're going to talk to people about this. You should be talking to people about this. So what Brown Act really is intended to prevent is members conducting a private meeting among themselves either simultaneously or in sequence. So just bear that in mind. If you're speaking to another member of the committee with the intent of inducing that person to agree with you or finding out what that person feels to help you figure out what to do, bear in mind that you're getting on ice, and then it's only the width of the ice that's going to save you from violating Brown. So probably the easiest thing to do is just not to get too far out on the ice. That's the easiest way of saying it.
And discuss it here?
Yeah, discuss it here.
With each other. Collectively, yes. You can have anybody else.
Yeah, we want you to contact your constituents.
Just a brief comment that I guess I'm a little confused about it is, not confused, but my understanding here is that we're here to represent certain constituencies. So we need to talk to those constituents, of which we may also be, and you may also be, as a constituent of. But because we're not a decision-making body as an advisory group, and because our expressed goal here is to provide that knowledge and that insight to the decision-makers in developing the groundwater sustainability plan, it's in our best interest to share as much of that information, as contentious as it may be, as possible, because this is a highly politicized issue. But as opposed to other political environments where it might be more beneficial to Cloister or somehow. I don't think it's in anybody's benefit if we're actually here to represent our constituencies to do that sort of stuff. So we should be relatively, it should be fairly straightforward and simple for us. I think your question is, I just want to make sure I don't get myself into hot water just by trying to do the right thing, which is having communications.
Yeah, this is a little different because SIGMA requires that you represent those groups, those beneficial users, so it is a little tricky. But I think as long as you collectively bring those comments here to this board, that's what you need to worry about.
Or as I suggest to some of my clients, at all times, you never know when you've crossed under that thin part of the ice, so you might want to carry a clean toothbrush, because the jail issue about toothbrushes are very dirty. And a thick novel, a paperback novel, preferably warm, please. Just kidding.
But the, well taken, Joshua, it, and Samantha brought this up too, it's very important for you to be speaking with those you represent, right? It's when you start noticing that, oh, and look, four of us are all here talking to the same folks. That's when we, the ice might appear, start to appear a bit thin, right?
But just a comment, just a comment to that, as long as you're intaking information from the constituents and not discussing it necessarily between yourselves, you're inviting that conversation to happen and then bring it back here to talk about between the entire committee in a public forum, that's acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a good point, is that as long as the constituent's talking to you and giving you information, if you don't necessarily have that dialogue back and forth too much, you're just grabbing the information and bringing it to the group.
Yeah, and the thing is that it's going to be a really good thing if you're having those conversations. Then it would be beneficial for you to just share that back in this forum. And if at any time you say, oh, something appears to us like it could potentially be a brand violation, then we can air, we or inching towards that, then we can talk about it then. But we do not in any way wish for this to inhibit you from having those really important conversations with the public.
Well, then I think it's really important just everyone understands that this is a sensitive issue and there is a lot of distrust amongst the constituents. And when we try to have performers together and we don't invite the environmentalists, they're going to think, oh, something's up. But really, at this point, now it's because of the Brown Act.
Yeah, and I think you can hold those meetings individually to get some input to help you frame your position, individual position. But all of you now, even though you represent various groundwater users, beneficial users, you're in a different class now. You're no longer just a stakeholder because you've been appointed by a government body to do specific work. So you're different. And so that's why you can't collectively get together and even listen to in a meeting with constituents, even if there was three, four of you and you were just taking, you know, advice in from the public, they're going to want to present their opinion and you could be sitting there and nodding, and the person next to you could be nodding, and basically you're kind of indirectly kind of negotiating and agreeing with the other. So it's just a cautionary thing. I think the safest ground is just individually go out and meet with the broadest set of constituents you want, or individuals, and to help frame your own mind. And then how you come together and have that discussion to reach consensus and learn from each other should be done here, not anywhere else. And that's the safest ground.
Well, I think it's a great thing that it's requiring openness. But at the same time, the other side of the point, I think that it's also creating some distrust because everyone wants to be at the meeting, and at this point, it can't be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's true. We can all talk about that here now and say, hey, sorry, ahead of time. Or I think, like you said, it makes the, if we start getting that distrust out there, then it's time for us to do a public workshop.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so it's important for you to come back and share that information. If you've been having conversations where you feel like that's happening, it might be a really clear signal that we need to then zoom out, have an evening meeting, and make sure that we're having those discussions. Okay? Okay, thank you. last bit on the this one agenda item, that advisory committee roles and responsibilities, is the communications and engagement plan. This communications and engagement plan is high level. It has been approved by the GSA board. It is an informational item for you. I first want to start with any questions or comments that you might have about the plan based on your own advanced reading. And then I do want to have us zoom into a couple parts of the plan which implicate you as an advisory body. So let's start with any questions or comments that you have just in your own reading of it that you'd like to discuss with the committee, if anything.
Question.
Yes.
Do you run the online post specifically to the Community Management Committee then?
Yes, so the online post happened. Durham Irrigation District is responsible for that. So all of the agencies, when they came together, decided sort of who was going to provide what in-kind contribution. That's why Durham Irrigation District is in charge of the website. And so Tammy Loser is the person who does that. So I coordinate with all of the management committee, and then Tammy and I push out the notifications following grant.
I'm talking about that social media.
Oh, social media.
Yeah.
Okay, social media is sort of left to the member agencies to use their existing social media tools if they have them. Presently, the Vina GSA, as far as I know, tell me if I'm wrong, does not have their own social media as an agency.
Correct.
Beyond the website. Yeah.
Is that something we want to do in the future? I think we should probably discuss that in the management committee and see what our capacity is at this point and what's ahead of us and prioritize that.
Great.
Decided.
Okay.
And that will go to the board to decide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. And any other general questions or comments before we go to some specifics in the plan? Alrighty. Under the GSA, under the outreach rules, you'll see that the what we refer to broadly as the governance structure of the Vina GSA is really the interrelationship between these different elements of the agency. And that is the decision-making board, the groundwater sustainability agency board, the management committee as its important staff presence, where the management committee is involved here and at the board, and also is the mechanism to carry your recommendations up to the board and for them to then carry down whatever board messages back to you. So they're an important piece of sort of joinery, the glue. And then the stakeholder advisory committee. And you know what your charge is because we've just completed the charter. And as you see there, it's at a higher level. It says your charge will be carried out through various activities, which includes actually seeking input from represented stakeholder groups on groundwater-related issues. We just had a good discussion about that. Within the context of the Brown Act, sharing input and feedback at these meetings. So you go and get that information from those you represent, you bring them to these meetings, and you make recommendations to the board. And again, it states in this paragraph here that it is all of you, the board, the management committee, and the SHAC, are committed to keeping the public informed
to get information and creating the open process for their involvement. I think it's important to just mention this last paragraph more explicitly when evaluating the options and making decisions. The board, management committee, and the stakeholder advisory committee will solicit public input through a variety of methods, including public workshops, written and verbal comments, meetings with stakeholder organizations, and other input can be made during public comment periods at these meetings, as well as board meetings and in writing. I just wanted to make sure that where you were mentioned, that we went over that explicitly. And then on page 5, it talks about the different venues or forums for communication and engagement, and then some of the tools that we're currently using. So anything among the SHAC members that you would like to discuss related to this plan before I then go to the public? Okay, it's just one of these. I see that some of you have created binders for this, which I love. So this will just be one of those documents that, you know, is foundational, like the charter, once it's finalized, that you'll want to reference. Anything else from the chat? How about the public?
Is this document online somewhere?
It's on the website, the vinagsa.org. VinaGFA.org. And do we have any additional extra packets? Because you may...
I have one.
Okay. And if you'd like a hard copy, we have one extra copy of the material. Just for your ease. Thank you, Linda.
Sure.
Any comments from the staff or about the plan? Fantastic. Well, that was a lot of process-oriented stuff. Thank you for your tolerance. Let's see where we are with our time. We're good. Let's move on. Christina, I think you're up to talk about the basin-getting components of the groundwater plan. And really, the purpose of your presentation, right, is to introduce some of the basic water budgets and groundwater data.
Yep.
Right? And I've got your presentation right here. Get you up and running.
Is this, we've got CD 10 under the calendar, under the items for this meeting, but we'll move it to a more easy to get to spot.
Okay, so, hi, good morning, Christina Buck, and most of you. So, we are going to start rolling out basin setting results starting next meeting, and so I wanted to take an opportunity to give a little background on what are going to begin to see and different pieces of the groundwater sustainability plan. Some of you have been in the water world for a long time and this stuff is familiar, and some of you maybe not so much. So this is, like I said, just kind of some of the building blocks, not focusing on results yet today. But if there's terms that I'm using that you're familiar with, or jump in at any point and ask questions. So interactive will take some time today to just give a little bit of background so that next month when the consultant team comes, they can hit the ground running with results, of course. That will be very interactive and questions are always welcome along the way too, but this way you get hit with things a couple different ways. So the groundwater sustainability plan is under development, and we've peeled off kind of the first half and we're calling it the basin setting project. And this is these chunks of the plan. There's kind of five main parts of the groundwater sustainability plan that we have to work on. And the basin setting has a hydrogeologic conceptual model. I'm going to talk more about what the heck that is. Groundwater conditions, water budget, management areas have already been kind of draft created for the Vina sub-basin. So we have the North Vina, which is north of Chico, River Chico, and then the south Vina. So those are generally set. It's possible that those could change, but I think for now that's what we're moving forward with. So not too much there. And then monitoring networks. And then those really become the basis for understanding what the conditions are in the subbasin. And then as we understand what the lay of the land is, then we'll get into the sustainable management criteria. And that's what, right now there's an RFP out to hire a different or a new consultant team under a new contract to complete the GSP process. So we're in this realm right now, the basin setting work. And as I think you probably know, it's one project that's developing this information for all three of the sub-basins. But it's going to get rolled out sub-basin specific because it lands in three different plans. So one of the things that SGMA talks about and requires you to include in your plan is this hydrogeologic conceptual model. I think it can be a little bit confusing to use the word model in a couple different ways. And so in this case, HCM, or hydrogeologic conceptual model, is really just our description of what the lay of the land is in the subbasin. So the requirement, the regulation requires there's a narrative, so written description, and then a graphical representation to provide an overview of the physical basin characteristics, uses of groundwater, and it really sets the stage for the rest of these basin setting components. So this is an example of an HCM that's in DWR's, they have these documents called best management practices that give you guidelines on how to put this stuff together. And so it's very cartoony, right? It's trying to just paint the picture of what are the major components at play in your sub-basin. Of course, this one has things that we don't have, like recharge basins and oceans and things like that. But it's really just the lay of the land, geographic setting. So for us, we're going to see probably foothills on the east side and the city of Chico as an urban use and ag land and a rural residential that's spread throughout in small communities like Durham and Nord that have, you know, that are groundwater dependent. So it's a graphical representation of what are the major things that are happening in the sub-basin that interact with the groundwater system. And that includes then also some geology, basin geometry, so what's the shape of the basin, right? We just think big picture. We've got Coast Range, Sierra Nevada, and Cascades, and this big groundwater basin in between. And the Vina sub-basin is a piece of that. And water uses that are going to talk about water quality. So that's our HCM, which is this kind of very descriptive picture and narrative that describes what's going on in our sub-basin. So then the next important piece is water budgets. And water budgets are really adding numbers then to our narrative, right? So we have this kind of similar picture of what the major components are, and now we're going to start to calculate and estimate things and put numbers to them. So runoff and diversions, you know, stream flows that are coming into the sub-basin. We've got the Chico Creek, Deep Creek, ephemeral streams that run when it's rainy and then they dry up during the summer. Recharge, water demands, pumping. We're going to start to put numbers to each of these different inflows and outflows. So that's kind of water budget language, right? Inflows, what's coming into the sub-basin, and outflows, what's going out. And we like things to add up, right? So inflows should equal outflows, or something changed. So you either have more water in the system or you have less water in the system if those inflows don't equal the outflows. Maybe I'll stop for a second. Any questions about that hydrogeologic conceptual model?
Under subarticle 2, basin setting, where it talks about hydrogeologic conceptual model, it says that the model shall be summarized in a written description. But it goes into more detail than what you have up there. It would define, for example, here the Tuscan formation in relatively great detail. And the question I have is, and these are all good because it gives you a general idea what's going on. But the problems we're going to have here is going to be somebody's going to want to recharge an area, and they're going to say, for example, which is coming up, we own this area. And someone else is going to say, no, we don't. This doesn't tell you that. So from what I read in the SGMA is those hydrogeologic conceptual models need to be relatively detailed. My question is, do they do flow flow paths? Are they regional? Are there going to be local models? Because that's what it's going to come down to. We're going to have really detailed models. And is that the direction we're going? And I get the understanding on some of the things, yes, in 2 or 3 years. But we're already having problems today with like you said, we're not, you and I are against each other. There's a lot of distrust. And so in reading the Sigma, and I think the reason that they, because I've seen this before over the years, the reason they want this really detailed is this will all go well until it doesn't. And then you'll have to have public meetings because large numbers of people will get irritated and they will force issue. It's much better if we have more detail than what I'm seeing up here.
Yeah. So I think we go to the detail to the extent that we have it and can. So I agree with that. And I think we need multiple levels of kind of detail, right? We need kind of the broad, we need what are the major things that we're estimating and calculating. And then there's how does this groundwater system actually work? What's the geology? And getting into that. And some of that is required as part of your HCM. So there's kind of this map set that the regulations call out on topography and soils and land use and water source. And then there's geology, and it requires at least 2 cross-sections. That's not a lot, right? That's not enough to understand project-level detail. And so I think there's the HCM, which is going to be higher level and going to pull in the detail that we can. But then there's project-specific and policy-specific information that has to be greater detail. And so if there's specific projects, recharge projects, or other things, I don't think that lands necessarily in the HCM. I think it lands in the analysis for that project. And if we don't have the information we need, then that's a data gap, right? And that's kind of the definition of data gap for Sigma, is that you don't have the information that you need to really make the decision that you And so it's going to be a combination of leveraging the detail that we do have and then really identifying what those data gaps are and pursuing the ability to fill them. So I think that's a good point. But there will be kind of different levels of detail that show up maybe in different parts of the plan. Any other questions or comments so far? Okay, so we have 3 interacting systems, and I think that's the other, just one more thought on that, is that's why you all are here as an advisory group. So as you put information together, you can help identify where those levels of detail are that are important, right, that will help build trust, or where the gaps are that are not helping us build trust. So that's a big part of, I think, the feedback you can help. So we have 3 interactive systems that both Sigma talks about, and as we start to put water budgets together, these are kind of ways that you think about how the system is interacting with itself. So surface water system, these are your creeks, streams, if you had lakes, anything water on the surface of the land, right? That's your surface water system. Then you have this land system, so that's your agriculture or your urban setting, what's going on in terms of precipitation. Precipitation and water demand, evapotranspiration, that's your land system. And included in that is typically kind of your root zone system. So if you're thinking about irrigation schedules, applied water, things like that, that's your land system. And then you have your groundwater system. So all 3 of these systems are interacting with each other, right? There's lots of feedback between streams that are getting diversions to then meet irrigation demands, streams that are interacting with the groundwater system. So here, sorry, this is blurry, we have recharge, right, where you have infiltration and precipitation. So it rains on the land, it either runs off or soaks in. We're going to have a number or an estimate for all 3 of those kind of flow paths of where that water went. And then another infiltration is surface water by source type, right? So that's your creeks and streams. So what's Butte Creek contributing to the groundwater system, or what water is moving from Butte Creek, or from the groundwater system into and being discharged into surface water. So there's an interaction between our creeks and streams, right, with the groundwater system in time and in space. So certain stretches of a creek might recharge, a different stretch might have groundwater feeding into it, and that's why we have flows in the summertime when it's not raining. And so it can change in space or it can change in time, right? So we're going to try to estimate and put numbers to all this stuff. Some of these things you can think, okay, we have pretty good data on that, right? Precipitation, we've got rain gauges, but even that, we know varies in space. So all of these things are estimates. There's a lot of averages and error bars in these things, but magnitudes are helpful, right? What are the big ones? And sometimes we think things are really important, and then we look at the big picture, and it's 1% of the whole system. And so maybe it's important, but maybe it's not really going to influence our decisions in the grand scheme of things. So even though these numbers can be blurry and there's estimating, seeing how they relate to each other, what the relative sizes of them can be helpful to really understand what are the important pieces of the system and how they interact. And then the groundwater system, right, is getting both recharge, pumping is a major outflow from the recharge from the groundwater system, but then we also know there's groundwater movement, right? So there's groundwater moving into the subbasin, and there's groundwater moving out of the subbasin. So this is a figure, again, that is also in the DWR Best Management Practices document that shows these required ins and outs for the water budget numbers. So you'll begin to see these numbers next meeting when the consultant team comes and presents.
Typically, where is imported water or exported water shown in this model?
Yeah, good question. Probably surface water inflow by source. Yeah. So if you had, and then it would, where does it go? It's going to either go kind of to the land surface, the land system, if it's applied water for your region, or to an urban setting. Any other questions on this? Yeah,
Barry. I'm maybe jumping ahead a little bit, but I'm just looking at the rest of the agenda here. I'm very concerned about the surface water inputs by source and these percolation ponds, and how does, and this is not necessarily your area of expertise, but how does the legality get figured out? Whose water is that after a percolation pond? Who is the owner now? And who has the rights once it goes underground? And then who has the right to charge my neighbor if I'm the one that put it in? And all of those issues. And there's a little bit here about our basin transfer rule is going to be discussed a little bit, but even that is different than ownership of water going in from different sources.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that under that agenda topic, because I think it can land in that topic, yeah.
Does the subsurface groundwater inflows for our region include the pressurized lower Tuscan that leaks up through fissures in the aquitard? I mean, you're talking about the lateral, but what about how the pressurized artesian pressure actually supports what's above it?
Yeah, so, yes. So, basically you're saying, how are we defining our box, right, that we're estimating numbers into? So, part of the HCM and this is to define kind of base to freshwater. And that's essentially your groundwater system that you're going to quantify things for, unless there was a reason to go deeper, and there might be for water quality reasons. So that's kind of something. But yeah, I think you kind of carve out your box, and that lateral includes what's going on in the deepest part of the system, which is the lower, the deepest lower Tuscan system that does have this pressurized upward gradient in some places. So I think two things. One, you're estimating what's going on down there, ins and outs. But what you're actually getting at more is what's the dynamic kind of within the system of that, those vertical gradients. And how are those, what are they now, and how are they over time, and how do we kind of watch that track it and understand it is our, talk about this, is multiple, or is our multi-completion monitoring wells, right? That we can look and see if there are these vertical gradients, which means your deepest has a higher groundwater level than your shallower zone, so you have flow from deep to shallow. We started looking at these hydrographs with the TAC, with the Technical Advisory Committee, to identify one of the things you have to define in Sigma is what your principal aquifers are. And in the Vina Sub-Basin, I think we're going to want to look at the whole system altogether because it's not super clear that there's, throughout the whole Vina Sub-Basin, that there's this separate kind of upwelling of water. It varies a bit. So, but that's our best data set right now, is the multi-completion vertical gradients to keep an eye on and understand what that dynamic is in the Vina Sub-Basin. And that should be part of our HDM. That should be part of our, at least narrative, understanding of how groundwater is moving through the system.
So it's my understanding that we don't really have an HDM developed yet, a comprehensive one.
Right. And that will be, that will come out. I think you're going to start it. We're going to basically start to see the pieces over the next 2 months in terms of the water budget and the map set that we build that, and then the narrative will kind of put that all together. And that should be drafted by May.
And will that go outside the boundaries of the Vina GSA?
Yeah, I think we need to put the Vina, because we're part of the bigger Sacramento Sub-Basin, or groundwater basin, it will be put in context, yeah. Yep. Good. Any other thoughts? Okay. So I want to switch gears, and we talked about kind of the HDM is the conceptual model, is our narrative. Then there's, we talk about models too, right? The basin groundwater model is a numerical model. That means it's got lots of numbers in it. It's a number crunching. So the view-based groundwater model is the tool that that was chosen to support basin setting development and to develop the water budget numbers, at least some of them. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
Okay.
The view-based groundwater model has the same name as the deep sub-basin. They're different, right?
Yes, they are. And we've actually, it's good to hear that, we've talked about renaming this thing because of that confusion. So the view, and some of you were here when this model was birthed back in the 1990s, and it was the Butte Basin groundwater model. It covered originally what were the four sub-basins, so Vina, West Butte, East Butte, and North Yuba, which is now Wyandotte Creek, and that was referred to as the Butte Basin, the whole system. The Butte Basin, the other Butte Basin groundwater users, Butte Basin Water Users Association, so that's where this name comes from. Now we have the Butte Sub-Basin under Sigma, so now we probably need to rename the model, but yeah, thank you for that. Does that make sense?
Does it cover the other sub-basin?
It does. So it does. So,
they're
not directly included in the model. Okay. So this Seminole River flowing right here, because it's the boundary and then it flows out. But any water that would get diverted, which we don't really have, but diversions, that would be an inflow into the mine sub-basin. But just because it's flowing along the sub-basin, we're not going to include that flow in the water budget. But there's recharge from, so that would be included, right? Our estimate of...
Or any water that would
flow into the river, that would be an outflow, yeah. Does that kind of answer that question? Yeah, so it's a little bit...
Yeah, that's kind of...
So from a sub-basin's perspective, the river is just kind of flowing by, and to the extent that it interacts with the sub-basin, we'll account for that, but if it's just passing by, we're not going to...
And then for our sub-basin, again, just these little minutia, but Big Chico Creek is not listed in here.
Sorry, what are you
playing? Well, I was just looking at the monitoring thing. And I noticed that Sacramento River is included, a bunch of other, you know, Rock Creek, Mud Creek, et cetera, but then Big and Little Chico Creek are not included. Was that just a, here's an example of some of the
water? The next sentence says the additional water.
Okay, that's what that,
yeah.
Okay.
Included in the WIP.
I'm sorry,
can I
say that again?
Additional waterways are included in the water inventory analysis, so...
I was just saying, here's an example.
Every single one of them, but it wasn't. Right.
That's
a
good question.
Good question.
Good question. Good question.
Okay, so this is the tool that's going to be used to estimate a number of these pieces of the water budget, right? So we have some of the numbers that the model is using are numbers that we give it based on data and measurements that we have, right? So precipitation is an example of that. Rim flows, which is like Big Chico Creek coming into the sub-basin from the east to the outside, or View Creek, right, that's a stream flow. That's information that we give the model, or that we put into the set of numbers that it has, evapotranspiration, and crop water use that's specific to different types of crops, diversions, right, that we know are coming out of the creeks or streams for different uses, urban uses, these are all specified, and data that's put into kind of this big number printer. And then there's things that we don't have data for, right? Pumping, agricultural pumping that's not measured or monitored or reported, so that's estimated on how the model goes about doing that, but that's one of the reasons we want to use this integrated model that is accounting for all three of these systems in kind of an interactive way, because it can help us estimate things that we don't have data directly for. So pumping is one of those, agricultural pumping. And then stream groundwater interaction, right? How these streams are interacting with the sub-basins, with the groundwater system, because that's dependent on conditions in the stream and conditions in the groundwater system. And as both of those change, their interaction changes. And so when you put all these different types of information into one spot that has physics driving equations that makes them calculate numbers, you can try to integrate and account for those changing conditions in different parts of the system.
Christina?
Yeah.
If we look at this and we think of that stream as being the Sacramento River, and on the left side is Glen County, and on the east side, on the right side is Butte County. And you can see that it shares an aquifer. Mm-hmm. Now, what's underneath that is that my understanding is it kind of tilts from the Sierra Cascade down underneath the river. And so I'm wondering if we are including in our water budget the deep wells that have been installed on the other side of the river that are tapping the shared aquifer, and how we quantify that in our water budget. For instance, when Gokul's Irrigation District did a testing of those wells to find out it was recharging from the east and the northeast. So it was pulling water out from underneath the economy and pulling it into their wells. And how are we going to coordinate with them? And how are we going to include that in any modeling that we're doing? So
So if water levels on the east, on the west side of the river are lower than they are on our side of the river, water's flowing across that line to the west, and the opposite is true. And those happen at different, in some areas water's flowing this way, in some areas water's flowing this way. And that's one of the reasons these integrated models are helpful too. They don't, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, but they can give us ideas about how these changes in the system are translating into flow directions. So as Jim pointed out, I think one of the great limitations of the View Basin groundwater model is that it stops at the Sacramento River. So because of that, we can't use it just by itself, right? There are other groundwater modeling tools that our neighbors are using, that the Calusa Sub-Basin is using a refined version of the Department of Water Resources C2VSIM, Central Valley Simulation Model. It uses the same code, so there's a lot of consistency in how it goes about calculating things, so that's kind of nice. And as our consultant team is updating and refining the Deep Basin model, they're working with the regional model as well to kind of check both how the groundwater levels are being represented, because that's the driving factor between in terms of which direction the groundwater is flowing, and also the volume of water that's being estimated to go across that line. So that coordination is happening at kind of that technical level by using a couple different modeling tools, but then also data, right? What does the groundwater level network indicate kind of direction of flow is as well? So combination of types of data to try to answer those questions.
Well, how are we communicating with the other side of the river? How is this data being communicated to groups such as this advisory committee?
Yeah, so I think we're in early stages at this point, right? And Davis Engineering is doing our basin planning work in coordination with a couple other firms. They're also working and have done some of the water budget data with in the Calusa Sub-Basin. So there's good just kind of technical knowledge background on that. Kind of within the consultant team that's working on this stuff. But I think as we get results, they have a technical advisory committee, both for the Glen Calusa Groundwater Authority has a technical advisory committee, and the Calusa Groundwater Authority has a technical advisory committee. They sometimes have joint committees. We might have a joint committee, right? So there's going to be opportunity as they push out results and as we push out results to make sure that those are or to identify what the data gaps are.
So that will happen in the Butte Tech, not in the Butte
no.
GSA, but the Butte Tech.
No, sorry. So I said TAC, that's in the Calusa Sub-Basin.
Yes.
They have TACs. I think they would probably come with you guys, with the SHAC and with the advisory board and the Calusa Sub-Basin. Right now, we're coordinating just information sharing-wise through the IWM. That meets, there's a technical advisory committee of the Integrated Regional Water Management Board, which is the 6-county area. So right now, that has been the forum for sharing information. What consultant's doing what, where are you at in Sigma development?
Just to add a few things, in the groundwater sustainability tank completion project that will be kicking off this spring, that's a specific task that is going to have to be looked at, is the analysis of what adjoining sub-basins are doing in their GST and the analysis of how it will affect ours and vice versa. This is not just a nice thing to do, it's required, we are going to do it, it might involve some other modeling. And then additionally, Tanya, Tanya said, I don't know if you introduced that you're here now on behalf of Facilitation Services from DWR, no longer on the grant, and as part of the task order to facilitate these meetings, there's another task to facilitate interbasin interaction. On a regional basis. So she'll help facilitate those discussions, which like we may go through the NSD IWM or others, but there'll be public meetings, interactions,
how do we want to approach this? What might be the forum? And I think because these agreements are just getting going, it's important for us all to be thinking about it, but it's still a little bit early. And so just to know that also in those conversations outside of Butte County, and we can hopefully leverage some of the resources from the different grants to do that coordination.
Great, yeah. Yeah, and that's a good point. Just, Connie just mentioned some of these other subjects, right? So from Vina's point of view, we have a north neighbor, that's the Los Molinos subbasin. This is the Corning subbasin, so this is Stony Creek. So Corning, good part of that. And then the Palouse subbasin, actually just a tiny bit, because this is where Vina is. So we're mostly the Corning subbasin, and then of course the Butte subbasin to the south. So we've got three or four neighbors.
Have you calibrated the Butte Basin groundwater model yet?
It's underway right now. The consultants are
working on it.
Frantically working on it, yeah. Yeah, so it's currently being calibrated.
How many GSAs within the Sacramento Valley kind of main aquifer, as opposed to all of California, which includes coastal regions and Sierra Nevada? I'm just curious.
We'll start now. So probably, we have 11 in the Butte Subbasin alone, so probably 18-ish.
This boggles my mind how even within a shared aquifer, there's going to be enough coordination to have monumental task.
It's going to be an effort.
Created for yourselves.
Yes. Yep. So
I have a question. A couple of staff members have to feed the meter or go to the bathroom.
Okay.
So where are we in your presentation?
Yeah, I think I'm going to cut it short because we've had really good dialogue. So 5 more minutes?
Can we wait 5 minutes?
I'm right at the end of my...
Let's just break right now.
I got 10 hours. I think it's 10 hours.
decision.
There is actually.
And if this one may be allowed, these are what's going to be the question.
I can't. I'm sure.
downstairs and round people up. I don't want to delay. So we should go. So Christina's going to take 10 more minutes. And then realizing that this is just an introduction and we're going to continue, this is going to be iterative, we're going to continue to deepen and deepen our understanding of it. Oh, that would be great. Thanks, Paul. Okay.
Okay, so you saw the slide already. I just want to mention a couple things that are here. So the GeoMix groundwater model runs, has historical data and information from 1970 to 2018, and it's crunching numbers on a daily basis. Most of these regional models are monthly models. So having a daily time step, as we say, is really a pretty zoomed in level of detail, which can be important for irrigation scheduling, right? I mean, if you're thinking about what water use is like on a daily basis, that's quite a bit different than on a monthly basis. And also for stream flows, right? How the stream is changing on a daily basis and how that then can interact with groundwater is a different dynamic than a monthly time step. So that's, I think, it's one of the key reasons that we, that it was recommended to go ahead and use this model, even though it cuts off at the Sacramento River there. So there's some give and take, but because of a greater level of detail in other ways, the GeoMix and the groundwater model, I think, will give us some different depths of information than some of the other regional tools. So basically, things get calculated on these triangle basis, right? So data gets put in at that level, and they range from 670 acres with an average of about 112 acres. So that's kind of the level of detail that information is put into the model, and I already talked about boundaries. So I started kind of diving into the details of the groundwater model coming from the water budget perspective. It's helping us estimate some of these water budget numbers that are required for the plant. But I want to back out too a little bit and just thinking about groundwater models in general, right? They're tools. If groundwater is hard to see, we don't really exactly know what it looks like, we understand geology, we have monitoring wells that give us the picture, we kind of have all these different lines of evidence. Groundwater models are one of those lines of evidence, right? They can fill in a lot more detail than we even actually have. So we use them as a tool to understand how things might be interacting, but they're just kind of one piece of the tool belt toolbox to understand what groundwater is doing. And then it's still blurry, right? Because we can't actually see what's going on. So again, this is kind of a zoom in of what these elements look like. Land use is the data input, and for the GeoBasin model changes every year. So, you know, we'll say this is almonds and there's 70 acres of almonds in that element, and maybe it changes, you know, over time. So there's a time series of changing land use on an annual basis at this kind of granular level throughout the model. And so one thing I just want to mention to give you a little background when you see water budget numbers next time is that number for groundwater pumping, where does that number come from? Right, so the groundwater models basically are our calculator for estimating first crop water demand given land use, crop acreage, climate conditions, precipitation, and ET, again, on a daily basis. And then it's driven by soil and physical properties. So, and that is all kind of combined into an irrigation scheduling type approach, right? So you have target soil moisture. If you're in ag, you're familiar with kind of how you decide when to irrigate based on how wet your root zone soil profile is. And so the model, we give it some parameters on what you're trying to hit. Try to keep this 3 feet wet, you know, and then the soil drains. So it refills it with precipitation first. If there's not enough precipitation, then it gives it an irrigation. So whether it's an irrigation from surface water or groundwater depends on whether we've said, hey, you have surface water available to you to meet your irrigation demand. So we also have diversion data that is put into the model that's potentially available surface water. If there's no surface water, then it's met by groundwater pumping, right? So that's how groundwater pumping is estimated using this tool. And there's a representative well, essentially, for every triangle, and that well is meeting the demand
diversions take,
sorry.
Do the diversions take into account losses along the way? Or are they assumed to be effective rates and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so diversions, you have diversion from the river, that's like one number, and then you actually have the delivery, which can be a different number, accounting for losses. Okay. So I'm going to switch gears. The other piece of the basin setting is groundwater contamination. We talked about this some already. This is really also relying on monitoring networks, right? And so you've seen some of this stuff today before, but I'm just going to give it real quickly in the next couple minutes. These are wells, right? Ag well on the right, domestic well down in the middle, a dedicated monitoring well that has different depths. I'll zoom in on one of those. And wells are really our window, right? The model can help fill in some of the gaps sometimes, but wells are our window both for understanding geology, right? When you drill a well, they can map out what type of material they hit at different depths. And it's also our window in understanding what the groundwater level conditions are and what water quality is at different places and different depths. So this is an important part of our monitoring network and of our data set. So we have a couple different things that we can do with the groundwater levels, and this is one of the ones. This is a map that DWR produces. This is a contour map that shows groundwater flow direction. So again, like I mentioned before, groundwater flows from high to low. So like a topo map, right, where you have elevations, if you're hiking, you have, you know, tighter lines, it's steeper. So you have a mountain there. Well, same thing. You have kind of a groundwater mound here, actually. And this is the Stony Creek Fan. So this let's orient you, right? So here's Chico, Sacramento River, Orland. So here's Vine Subbasin. Groundwater flows. So they're using all these black dots. Those are the wells. We have well level elevation there. And it's all relative to mean sea level, right? So now we can compare levels across space. And so groundwater is flowing perpendicular to our contours. This is just a spring, this is the spring 2019 map. But we can look at different times by contouring different data sets and looking at different maps to see how these flow directions change in the spring or in the fall, during drought years or during wet years, right? So this is not static, it's changing depending on what the groundwater level conditions look like out there. And these are for 150 to 450 foot wells. So this is one type of map that you'll see and that will be part of the package is a contour. The other map, and you've seen these before, are change maps. And this is changes over space, but for a snapshot in time. So we're going to compare what conditions were like in one year, in this case spring 2011, to spring 2019, and what's the change over the region. And so this is where you see, you know, these big declines on the west side of the valley. In Vina, it's on the order of 2 to 6 feet in most places, and we actually had a couple wells that came up. So it's just a quick, easy way to say, are things coming up or are things going down, and where is that happening? But this does not show groundwater flow direction, right? This doesn't actually mean that all the water is flowing into this hole right here. And then we have graphs that show data changes over time, but for one point in space, right? So now we're looking at what the groundwater level looks like at this well that I've been measuring, you know, since 1960. And so you can see patterns over time. So all these different pieces of information also help us understand what the groundwater conditions are. This is, and I'll kind of conclude with this, this is one of our multi-completion wells. They've got, in this case, four different, it's one borehole that was drilled, and then four different PVC pipes that are screened at different levels. So there's a shallow one, might be 100 feet deep, and then it's, cement grout in between, so they're isolated from each other. So you can measure what's happening in the shallower portion of the aquifer system in kind of an intermediate zone, so maybe this is 350 feet down, and then in the deep zone, maybe it's 1,000 feet down. So at this one point, we have sometimes three different elevations of what groundwater level is at, even in that one spot, and that gets to what we were talking about earlier in terms of these vertical gradients. What's the dynamic? Is groundwater moving upward or downward? Not only, you know, horizontally. And so in this case, the shallow zone has a different, higher level than this intermediate zone. And here you can see lots of pumping, right? So things recover. This is fall. Start coming up. And then you get some pumping. something, maybe frost control sometimes happens in the winter and you'll see that, and then the irrigation season starts and you get pumping, and then you have this recovery curve. So that's kind of the general pattern in groundwater level data. And this data is daily data. So again, you have kind of this is from spring, you get spring, fall, summer is your lowest. And so this is 2 to 4 times a year, kind of looks like this pattern. More detail shows you a little bit more activity in terms of what's happening in the groundwater system. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. And there will be more to come. The consultants, Dave's engineering team, and others will be here next time to actually present results on some of the water budget numbers and also groundwater conditions and some of those maps. So look forward to having more to look at this as we do that. Any final questions?
Your slides will be shared with us after the...
Yeah, we'll post them. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, feel free to contact me. Give me a call or email with any follow-up thoughts or questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Christina. So, Kelly, shall I pull up the chapter?
Yeah, if you could just pull it up and we can... I'll say if you can do that first, and then we can just go through with any particular comments for me for page.
Okay.
Okay, so we are looking at the first draft chapter. Now, they're not all going to come like this, right? Full draft chapters. But this one is a complete draft chapter for monitoring protocols for data collection and monitoring. I will pull it up. Go ahead and say whatever introductory remarks you want.
Sure. So this particular chapter is really just outlining the black and white of how to actually monitor for four major things. We're looking at groundwater levels, groundwater quality, land subsidence, as well as stream flows. And those are all mandated for SGMA and part of the GSP process. So this is relatively low-hanging fruit as compared to some of this other work that the group's doing with water budgets and trying to figure out some of the more complex things. But this is really the black and white of out in the field. How do you measure so that everything's standardized, everything's comparable, and really capturing the things that tell us our conditions in relation to those six undesirable conditions that SGMA is really revolving around. So first, the first part of it really has a review of the existing monitoring protocols that are in place. And so you can see for each of those four things, there's a list basically of what we currently do. Butte County's been monitoring a number of these things, at least groundwater levels, water quality, and subsidence for a number of years now, close to 20 years. That's been something that's a really high priority for the county, and so that's something our department has been doing. So we list the parameters and the protocol that we've used. And then what we do is we have BMP. So these are, DGBR puts out these best management practices, and this is for GSAs and groups to help develop their GSPs. So this basically says, okay, if you're going to do your monitoring protocol section, you should do it according to BMP. So we take our existing protocols, we compare it to this, we see what's different, and then we alter ours as needed to comply with what's in SGMA and regulations. So really, when you're looking at this document, everything that has that slanted, italicized font, that's directly out of this document. So for most purposes, we've tried to just stay to the letter of this BMP so that we do comply with that. If there are significant changes that just don't fit us locally, we indicate that as well. So so basically, groundwater levels, we've really been following DWR's guidance this entire time with our protocols. So we've included that in there. One thing to note that this monitoring protocol section is going to be different than the chapter that talks about where we monitor. So there's going to be a whole section on the monitoring network, and once the sites are picked, what's called representative monitoring network, that's going to be a whole separate. So this is more of a how-to, and that where to do it is coming in a separate. other things to mention, groundwater quality. If you are interested in more sort of information, we're going to put out an annual groundwater status report every year, and that's available online right now. I don't know if you're able to pull up the website by chance, Tanya, but there's a lot of good information in there too. If there's more questions or anything like that, we've got, you know, our current map, our current protocols, and a lot more information about sort of the ins and outs of what we're finding, what we're doing. But really, for groundwater quality, at least we have the program, and we're doing this groundwater quality program that looks at pH, temperature, and electrical conductivity. Those three parameters to look for the evidence of saltwater or saline intrusion from the very deep marine sediments, which if we start finding some of these things in our groundwater quality, it could be an indication of overuse of groundwater. So that program's been in place, I think, close to 15 years. We have 13 different sites throughout the county. So we're really continuing the work that we've been doing here in the county, including those protocols as part of this chapter, and just making sure they line up with what it says in SIGMA.
I'm sorry, Kelly, where would you like me to go?
On our department website, the County Water Resource Conservation, I'm just going to point out where you can find this annual groundwater status report, because it's got, you know, the whole year, last water year's information in there, and it's a good resource to kind of shape this whole conversation, I guess. In that, also, you'll see an appendix that maps out our current subsidence monitoring network. There's a series of continuous GPS stations throughout the entire county, but they go out and DWR will go out and measure from year to year, depending on the year. But that gives you basically a change in your groundwater or your ground surface elevation between 2 years of looking at that. So far, Butte County has not experienced any subsidence in all the years we've been monitoring. We also have three more, I don't know how to say it, but they're expensive stations that have a higher detail of measurements, down to tens of feet, and those are called extensometer sites, and there's three of those within Butte County too. If you go to reports on this website and write down from there groundwater status reports, first one down, that's a few previous years, but if you go back up to reports, and click on that red one, yeah, that'll take you right to all this information, so you can find out more about that. Now, as far as stream flow, which is our fourth piece that the protocols cover, the PMP and DWR's guidance really says to use the existing data and the existing monitoring stations that are already in place to the greatest extent possible. So basically what we've done is just refer to the existing USGS stream flow gauging sites, and there's a couple CDEC gauging sites as well. And so basically we're relying on, you know, the information that those agencies already collect to give us our information. So the first part is sort of explaining, here's our existing monitoring networks, and then how it was going to be included based on the information within this DMP, which you can see is italicized. So I'll be quiet now. but if there's any, like, we can go through the actual GSB chapter and see if there's any questions or comments, and just kind of go through it at that point.
I just have a general question.
Sure.
So I read through the protocols, and for a layman, I have a reasonable level of technical understanding anyway of what it's referring to, but in terms of being able to contribute to it in a meaningful way, I'm not going to be able to question best management protocols developed by many, many scientists over a very long period of time. So how is our time and our energy best used regarding this chapter specifically? Where's the feedback going to be actually useful? Because most of us are not water scientists.
And I think you have a good point, because that's, in essence, some of the approach that we've been taking is like, okay, if there's a real meaningful need to deviate from the BMPs that DWR has already established that say, please meet the letter of the law, then we're not going to. So I don't know if anyone has any
domestic well users have is the protocols for domestic wells, how that sampling might take place, who's responsible for it, et cetera.
Sure. And so basically the domestic wells would be measured the same way as agricultural wells, the same way as municipal wells, same way as these, Christina showed the monitoring wells that have three different pieces. The real only difference I think with some of those is that we do have hourly pressure transducers, and some of those which give us a lot of data versus a different frequency of monitoring. So currently we go out four times a year, and that may change depending on really what we find that representative monitoring network to be. So I think we can consider it to be pretty much apples to apples so that things are comparable. Currently, our department works with a lot of residential homeowners, and I'm out in their backyards in 3 weeks or so from now, and putting the tape down the well and getting those numbers. That would probably be something that I guess we continue to do already because of our own Butte County requirements. But the GSA may have, and the GSB might indicate that there's additional wells outside of that. So I think that's just to be determined in terms of like who does that. But.
Can I jump in here as a follow-up to your question? So the audience, really the audience for this monitoring protocol, I would say staff, who's doing the Sigma monitoring, right? And our own monitoring.
And I would say DWR staff, they want you to explain that you have an understanding about monitoring. And I mean, we've been doing it in this county for a long, long time. This GSAs, they don't have a monitoring program.
Got it.
Yeah. So,
but as a follow-up to your question, having read it, do you think it's useful, or if we wanted to encourage domestic well owners to monitor their own well, do you feel like this is accessible and, you know, friendly enough that they can pick up a monitoring protocol? Or do we really need to produce something different for that audience?
Yeah, no, I think you'd need to prove, I think for most folks, to even get them to consider it, you'd have to create a much more user-friendly, diagrammatic checklist. Here's, and then very layman's terms, here's why this is important to you as a user, and here's a very simplistic way that you can provide us with results. We'll, of course, compare that to our own sampling, given that you're not professionals at doing this, you know, maybe there's some factor of safety involved in there. I would say a separate kind of packet for them would be beneficial.
Are you considering that?
Not at this point, but I think to some degree that's potentially a project in action. Or it's kind of part of our monitoring network evaluation. Do we need, you know, are there data gaps in the monitoring network? How will we fill those? Is that the way that we fill them? And if we did, then we would fill them, something like that.
Yeah. I see.
Just to kind of dovetail onto that, under Section 3 for Monitoring Protocol for Inclusion in the GSP, 3.2 talks about training requirements. It says, although not discussed in the BMP, monitoring and data collection shall be completed by trained personnel. So that right there would, I assume, go through the entirety of this portion of this chapter to make sure and ensure that those people performing that data collection, whether they be a residential homeowner, domestic well user, or other, be knowledgeable on how to do the data collection.
And or maybe that data is taken as a separate subset and it's somehow calculated differently compared against professionally trained monitors taking measurements and then, you know, equalized to some extent given that there's going to be some margin for error there or something.
Right. Some sort of QAQC where you follow through and say how close are we and training.
Okay, well, this is an interesting idea. Thank you for that clarification, Christina, about if you find that there are gaps, that this may, a citizen science program for monitoring could be potentially something that would occur. Oh, okay, so one thing I just wanted to mention also within the context of Joshua's question and Paul, in terms of your response, it's staff level. internal to the basin and Butte County as well as for DWR. And it appears from 3.1 that it also will assist with situation coordination, right, with the staff of neighboring basins and their development of their GFP. So I understand, Kelly, that you've already shared this chapter with the TAC, and who else have you shared it with? Because you haven't actually received any comments. Everyone's sort of like, okay, internal document looks good.
Yeah, so we've actually shared this with, so the Butte County Water Commission has a technical advisory committee, and they reviewed this. We've shared this with the GSA managers from the Butte sub-basin, which is similar to the Vinus sub-basin, but a little bit farther to the south. We've also shared it with the management committee of the Wyandotte Creek sub-basin. So it's sort of gone through, you know, up to our internal department here. We've looked at it, and then we've sent it up to our TAC, and then to the management committees on all the sub-basins. And then now, from Wyandotte to the Shack, which will then provide it up to the Wyandotte GSA board, pending any feedback from you guys. And likewise, that will happen in those other two sub-basins here in Butte County as well. So that process will kind of happen up through the ranks that way as well.
One more quick question.
Sure.
I know this is for another time, but in the monitoring network discussion, is there a listing or calculation of the total number of domestic wells in the sub-basin as opposed to those that are specifically monitored?
There is not in this chapter. I'm sorry.
I'm sure somewhere I can get access to understanding how many actual domestic well users there are in the sub-basin.
Yeah, so we've been using data from we call it OSCAR. I don't know what the acronym stands for anymore, but it's the well completion reports that DWR collects. So basically what they do is they say section by section within an area, they have a total number of wells, and they split those out by ag, industrial, public, or it's public, production, and domestic. But they assign that total number to the entire section. So it's a little bit difficult to say, well, if your boundary is running right through the section, it's a little bit difficult to say whether or not that well is in or out. So we have some rough data, but they're purely estimates at this point. But we do have some information that we've gleaned from that data, at least, to be able to have a general idea of what that is.
Okay.
OSCAR, OSWCR.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh, there you go. Online system for well completion reports.
Yep. Yeah. And they do that by section because they don't, not everybody wants everyone to know that they have a domestic well on their property, right? So it's confidentiality. It's part of that.
I think I read somewhere there were 12,000 domestic wells in this region and something like 2,500 agricultural ones.
Yeah, there's been a few. I think that might be countywide.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so we've had a few different numbers out for different parts of the county. That sounds
familiar. And it might be a little tricky because the Vine of the Basin has boundaries have changed.
Right.
Yeah. Because part of it was West Butte, right? And so I'm not, and that occurred just a year ago.
Yeah. So we had some numbers, from before, and then we did some in between estimates. So Kelly has kind of the latest and greatest numbers, and we can bring those.
This is real data. I mean, they went out and measured. So when you calibrate your model, you're going to input well levels from specific levels. You push your button and the model calibrates. Ideally, it's going to come real close to this data. I say real close because it's going to vary. But this is, you'll look at this down the road and an area may not have a problem. Go, hey, look, it's been like this for 15, 30, 50 years. When they run their calibration, they may have a real a data gap. And so you come back to this and you'll plug into your model then. Or it'll tell you where to go look to see what the problem is. It could have been that you measured wrong. It could have been a whole bunch of things. But this is a very tentative way of seeing if you have a major problem. You can glance at, I know when you guys gave me some information, I looked through the pages, it showed wells, the names of the wells, shallow, intermediate, deep. And I went, oh, okay, and I ran out of time, I was going to put those in color. But when you like models, that's what this all sets up for. It's very boring, I don't like to go through it too much, but this is really great stuff. And they do a great job.
Joshua, you bring up something that I think staff and myself as a facilitator are taking as an important note. And so I just want to put a fine point on this, that you're going to be getting a lot of technical presentations. It is going to get more and more technical, right? And so from the SHAC perspective, I think we need to do the work of figuring out really what those questions are, what's the most meaningful input that we would like to get. Otherwise, it's so somewhat overwhelming and too diffuse, right? And so I just think it's important for us to take that forward, yeah, as guidance. So thank you for bringing that up.
Well, providing products that you can then go talk to your constituents about and say, here's some of the questions that come up and here's some of the answers to that, or here's some new graphics that kind of help explain some of this to them to get that good positive feedback or quality feedback.
Yeah, I think that's just my overall goal is, okay, I'm, putting my time into this, and I know it's a requirement of the process, but in order to make it something more than just checking the box, for myself personally, I want to make sure that I'm both getting something out of the process as well as contributing something to the process. And I couldn't go to constituents and ask them about groundwater monitoring protocols, per se. But if I can figure out a way where we can be useful, in giving you something other than the normal stuff that an average domestic well user, which you already know the answer, or at least you know the questions or concerns they're going to have, you don't need to repeat the fact that they're worried about, the people up in the hills are worried about agriculture or drawing down the aquifer, yeah, or people selling, what I mean, all the normal stuff.
So overall bullet points of, when somebody asks you, well, how do they monitor? Okay, well, it's all the same. It's all done by trained people. It's done at these locations. It meets these criteria. And then if you want more details, here's a link. Something like that is what you
do. And what are your concerns? Is it privacy?
Right.
Is it
sure.
Access?
And I guess a question that's coming up for me is that at prior public meetings during our governance discussions, there were a couple of times where you actually asked if there were any well users who wanted their wells monitored, right? Is that something you're still pursuing at the county level, or are you still trying to see who might be willing?
So we're kind of in a spot where...
Or the location of new potential wells.
Yeah,
that's what
right.
I was.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. We're at a spot right now where there's an opportunity through DWR's Technical Support Services where they're looking at, there's funding opportunities for installation of new monitoring wells, and those are the nested ones, right? So you have one borehole, you have three casings, and one's looking at the shallow levels, one's looking at intermediate levels, and one's looking at those deep levels. Right now we're working in the Nord area in three particular areas that we've drawn out the map, we see what wells are in the monitoring network, and we've kind of drawn circles around these areas that have a gap. And we're working with folks from Rock Creek Reclamation District to actually boots on the ground and go work with some of those landowners out there to see if they're interested in having that. So that's something that we're pursuing. But also if there's interest from anyone here, or if there's something more that you want to discuss about that, that's an opportunity. We're filling out the applications at this point. There are some criteria, it's got to be a certain size of land and et cetera, but if there's interest, I can go through that with anyone interested. We're also doing that in Wyandotte Creek Subbasin, because currently we don't have any monitoring wells with the nested features that way, so... Yeah, so that's something that I'm pushing ahead. So you can contact me directly if you have interest.
Okay, sorry, it wasn't directly related.
No,
there was some distant bell ringing for me, so thank you for accommodating that. Okay, so I think this was a good discussion to just help all of us understand, really, to begin to really think about how to bring this information in chapters to you. I'm gathering that there aren't any specific comments on the actual protocol from this chapter. But before I move on...
I do have some specific comments on the gaps.
On the protocol, on the chapter.
On the chapter on monitoring.
This chapter, yes.
Yes.
Okay, yes. Go ahead.
In 2007, Dan McManus with the Department of Water Resources and NAPWHA and several other hydro engineers put together a monitoring framework protocol. And in it, they had a section on habitat monitoring where they talked about the importance of a network of shallow monitor wells in the shallowest portion of the aquifer in areas where there's groundwater-dependent ecosystems. And groundwater-dependent ecosystems, of course, include streams, meadows, wetlands, but it also includes valley oak groves, which have been just decimated over the history of California. There's only maybe 2% left, and most of them, a lot of them, are here in Butte County, so it's really important from an environmental point of view that this important species be protected. And I think that we would do well to take their advice that we have a network of shallow monitoring wells in these locations where groundwater dependent ecosystem still exists in the shallowest portion of the aquifer. And keeping in mind that valley oak trees, when we're talking shallow, we're talking quite shallow. 80 feet is as deep as their tap root goes. According to some of the stuff I've read, 33 feet of water table is optimum for the health of valley oak trees.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question of you, Kelly. So you've already said that really later you'll come to the shack with sort of the where of the monitoring well. Is there anything in terms of protocols that responds to monitoring for GDEs, groundwater-dependent ecosystems, or these shallow aquifers? Anything related to protocols in particular? Or is that something we'll discuss later?
I think just in general, the fact that they're all monitored consistently and accurately and according to this is we're going to address that. And that, when you're talking about a shallow monitoring network, that's going to be more related to the monitoring network section and the representative monitoring section. Sorry. But that will be definitely involved because, like you said, the groundwater dependent ecosystems, you know, we're looking at anything 30 feet even, you know what I mean, according to some of the TNC work that's been done regarding that. So that's definitely a section that will come to you guys as well in terms of seeing, you know, how that's been laid out, our approach for identifying those, characterizing those, grouping those together, and then picking representative monitoring wells that will monitor how well those groundwater-dependent ecosystems are being affected by groundwater levels. And so picking the right ones that can tell us whether or not their conditions are changing.
So I think more the answer is that we will get into that, particularly around in future chapters, and we're taking note of it here. All right, so...
One more comment.
Yes.
On areas, the protocol also includes stream flow in this document that we're reviewing today.
And can you tell me where you're referring to?
This is on page 11.
Uh-huh.
2.4 stream flow.
I'm sorry, what's the number?
It's page 10, 2.4.
Page 11 of the PDF page 11.
Okay, 2.4. Yeah, got it.
And my reading of this is talking about the amount of water that are in streams. And there was mention today of so-called ephemeral streams that only flow during wet years. And I know that Rock Creek, Mud Creek, even Big Chico
Creek goes underground at certain times of the year. And all these streams are provide very important habitat, not just for the foundation of the food plant insects, but also for the most chosen habitat species we want to protect. For instance, in 1996, Dr. Paul Maslin identified Mud Creek as being an important spawning habitat, not spawning habitat, but rearing habitat for out-migrating anadromous fish. He found fish as far up as just to the north of the airport. And when these streams are dewatered, it not only eliminates this as habitat for rearing, which is really important for the success of these fish that are working their way back to the ocean.
So is there
a spreading out.
So I'm just wanting to get to, is there a particular comment or something you'd like to see included into the report?
As far as expanding the monitoring efforts to figure out when these streams go underground and correlating that with important species from an environmental point of view, I think this kind of monitoring is important and it's not included in this protocol. And I want maybe something for future, but I just wanted to bring it up now and kind of put a placeholder and make sure that we recognize the real importance of these small streams.
The ephemeral and small
streams. The so-called ephemeral streams. Yeah. Because these streams did used to flow year-round prior to exploitation of groundwater. And the fish are still working their way up and as they work their way back down the river.
Okay. So I'll ask the county, do you have any follow-up questions about that?
Not necessarily a question, but just sort of overall comment is that this kind of gets back to the, this is how we're going to do it, but not where we're going to do it. And so there is specific information on 21 about if we're establishing new sites, which could be identified in the data gap section. But this is how we're going to do it, according to the way that they've all been established. And so they are all
Thank you.
library USBs. DWR has a spreadsheet that they had to say, like, you have to cross-reference where you address all these things. I'm thinking that might be really useful. So I'll check that out, and we can bring something back. I think that would probably be helpful when you get some of this stuff from the consultants next month to see how it's fitting into the, you know, what pieces are we telling you about today and what are these other pieces that are.
Yeah,
so yeah.
That's really good. Just being able to see the overall framework and how this all fits in. So can we just work on that to see what might be a helpful sort of visual tool for us to constantly come back to. Thank you for that, Sheree.
And I just have one minor thing that I think goes back to what David said on the 2.4, that same, I think if we just added these include but are not limited to, because I think we're going to get others say, why is it two-peak in there, why is it this-peak in there, even though it's said later, just having that, that first line might stop a lot of questions if we can add that.
Or provide that context,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Below the list, it says additional waterways were listed and described in the 2016 water inventory and analysis report. So maybe we can check and see exactly what is included in that particular report.
Yeah, we may want to just change that reference to something more appropriate. We're trying to keep this chapter general, so that basically lands in all three subbasins, but I think we can reference a list that would be in the monitoring.
I just think it will bring up comments.
Like why do we choose those steps?
It's just a super simple language thing. Say, you know, an example of including but not limited to. We can have a conversation. Or
just a catch-all.
Okay, so just to revisit 2.4 to make that clearer, to give the context of including but not limited to, and then it sounds like you want to just rethink, or you're going to look at this reference to this USGS water supply paper, or what?
This is the 2016 water inventory analysis. What's under that list?
The 10 included.
Yeah, I see. Here, this reference. Got it. Okay. Good reference. All right, any final comments, realizing that we're a little bit late, and if we want to talk about the water transfer rule, we really need to move on. Okay. Thank you for your excellent input. Thank you, Kelly. And Paul, I will let you frame this discussion.
Thank you. Joining us on the phone is Valerie Kincaid, who's the legal counsel for the Biden GSA. Valerie, are you there? Okay. Can you hear okay? No, she would go out there. So anyways, there's been a lot of concern on a lot of fronts on some potential projects that may go on in the Vine Sub-Basin or other sub-basins and what that will mean to the long-term sustainability of the basin. One of the things that we had a discussion with the Vine GSA board back in October was to hit this straight on to develop a rule that would regulate out-of-basin transfers out of the Vine Sub-Basin. The Vine Sub-Basin, again, we're anticipating it's going to be in need to manage its water either through reduction or reduction of other surface water because it's 100% groundwater dependent. So having some of the issues that have occurred about entities getting ownership or management of water that could then be brought out of control and moved outside the basin would be against the purposes of what we've been trying to do and somewhat alarming. So the board did direct the management committee back in October to start to develop a rule that would regulate out-of-basin transfers. So we started, we drafted a process that you have before you on how we're going to do that. And one of the first things we're going to do is take a look at some of the issues that people have raised, and this will be a question for you all. If there are other questions and concerns we need to tackle, because the first thing we want to do not just write some rule in isolation. We want to understand what are our specific vulnerabilities we have in the sub-basin, what are the circumstances where there may be loss of control of water that could be moved outside the basin, and to make sure that we can address them head on. One, to help develop the rule, but two, I think as a guidance document, is some of these other potential projects might get developed, some guidance on how it can be constructed to avoid the problems and to have the Biden GSA exercise its authority to regulate and protect groundwater resources. In the end, once we identify those vulnerabilities and issues, those are going to be drafted up under Valerie's leadership and get some reviews from a legal review team that includes all the most of the legal counsels who have represented agencies in the basin who may have interest. And then based upon those that review, they'll take a look at comparing what the rules we currently have in the county. We have the Chapter 33, which is the Groundwater Conservation Ordinance that regulates out-of-county transfers, and there may be a nexus there that actually provides some control. There's also language in the Water Code that will need to be looked at on how some of the circumstances we might be facing are addressed either by Water Code. And then also there are things like the methodology for state water project conveyance. There's limitations on physically moving water out, and how does that fit with some of the concerns we have. So we wanted to tackle this in a real thorough way on a legal basis that would provide a good reference for long-term management and exercise of authority by the FINA GSA. So one of the main points I wanted to ask was, we've listed out, at least from the discussions and issues we've had, about three major scenarios. And one has to do with, for a while, we've been looking to have CalWater get a surface water supply. There was some discussion when the PID CalWater intertide project was being analyzed. One of the concerns was CalWater getting ownership of recharged water and subsequently having an ability to do things with that water outside their service area. And there was some listed questions, some references to the LA San Fernando Valley case that needs to be taken a look at, as well as some other circumstances. The second circumstance was the formation of the Tuscan Water District. That's going to be an ag water district in the Vina sub-basin of ag pumpers. They were looking to do a couple of things. One is purchase surface water to have growers reduce their pumping requirements and pumping needs, and then replace it with surface water, potentially do some conservation work, and also maybe some other recharge projects. So the question came in, as a water district, doing some of those activities, what sort of ownership or water rights would they control over that, and what vulnerabilities would they pose to the basin if they subsequently wanted to market that outside of the basin, which would run counter the basin with concerns. Similarly, and this covers probably a couple of the two, there's going to be some what they call flood mile projects. Using some of the natural high flows that occur in this area, especially in Boca Chica. There's good opportunities up there to use some of those high flow waters and do some recharge projects. Rock Creek's looking at one right now on Sand Creek. There may be some other opportunities. Through DWR process to put some guidance together. This is also tied up the state board on taking a recharge or a flood control project, but if people are using it for recharge, it kind of triggers water right permitting, and it's streamlined water right permitting. So there'll be some water rights issued to the entities that actually carry this up. And what does that go along with that, and then ultimately, what should the Bonner DSA board should we recommend to them to ensure that there's adequate regulation of that so we can prevent having some unsustainable things happening in the basin. Yes?
I guess under Unit 2, there, Issue 2, would be one of my greatest concerns is back to the real basics is what of these exercises could be detrimental to us who are overlying, have land over the aquifer, pump for irrigation, loss of our overlying landowners' rights to pump water. And there, I know that this has happened in some areas, and I think it's very important that we have true legal advice that would withstand our state or whomever to be sure that we do not lose the right to our to pumping without paying somebody.
Yeah, so the third bullet, how would this affect other groundwater uses, will broaden that out to affect any of your overlying existing groundwater rights.
Yeah.
And that's what exactly right. So is anything missed? Do people have other concerns? Bruce?
Yeah, on issue one, incorporating a surface water supply to Cal Water, Chico would allow them to reduce groundwater pumping. My question is, who's decided there is a problem in Chico? And then why is that a problem? And then it mentions PID. And the concern I have is if you build a pipeline from PID, what impact, and this is as a business representative, even though I'm GSA buying it, if you reduce the water supply to Paradise, what's that going to do to the buildings, lots in Paradise? And we're in a tremendous shortage of housing, and it's me, so it's just a whole bunch of things here on issue number one that, and I look at the Miocene Canal, everyone on that line had water. Once you lose your water supply, you may not ever get it back. And my concern with Chico is, first, that somebody's assumed that we have a problem. We do not have a problem with water supply. It's natural. It comes. It's been coming here for hundreds of years. Now someone's talking about taking us off the groundwater pumping. Why? I can understand managing it, but to guide us to just, that somebody decides we're just going to reduce it completely, it just seems absurd to me. And I live in Chico. My business is dependent on that. I have no problem with managing it and going to, you know, whatever streams we have to protect it. But this is just in a direction that I don't understand it.
I think the likelihood that in the Bina sub-basin, to bring it into a sustainable yield, there's probably a pretty good likelihood that there's going to have to be less pumping in the basin. You disagree with that? Or?
Well, you said today that you've got a numerical model. You haven't even been able yet to do calibration on it. And so, yes, there's going to be reduced pumping. By whom? Based on where?
And this,
you have a very nice ADM study that's being studied now that's looking like maybe it's 1, 2, 3 years out. So this question here to me would come 1, 2, 3 years out when you have your numerical model in set, because you don't know. If somebody decides this particular area over here, irregardless of whether it's Chico or Durham or across the river, is you're saying that this is a problem in the pumping. Based on what information? Because you have no models, no numerical, no conceptual model, nothing determining who's at fault.
Yeah.
So models are used for two things. The one I built was a copy of a contamination issue in Chico, and it's used flow paths to determine who's at fault. There is,
let me jump in.
But I want to finish what I'm saying. You're getting ahead of the gun here by doing this without having your model set up, because you have no way, one, to prove who did the recharge, and second, to defend yourself. Gary has nothing right now other than pump tests to defend himself. I think we're 3 years away, if the models are going to be built in, we're 3 years away from approaching. That's just my take.
Yeah, you're right. Sequence-wise, you know, we're going to need to get the water budgets out. You're all going to need to weigh in and get sustainable criteria going as to where the basin's going to be. All of this has to be done in less than 2 years, okay? Because the plan has to go in with at least what we know within the next 18 months. And that's going to include potential projects and actions initially. So all of this, and there's going to be other groups, other entities who are going to see regulations coming down and wanting to get ahead to do certain things, which has brought some of the concerns we've had to the final GSA board. So as entities start to look at projects and other things, because those have to be developed somewhat in the same time as these other basic setting works, sustainable criteria, we need to evaluate them or what people may do. And direction from the board is to put a rule in place that protects the basin from not having detrimental things occur. So you're right. I mean, it is, we're kind of going along parallel paths, but we have 2 years to get the whole plan in that includes potential projects and actions that others may bring to the table.
Just the sequence is really important here, right? You're going to see your initial basin setting results. You're going to start to understand better what the conditions are. You're going to see your water budget. On the basis of your water budget, you're going to develop a sustainability goal that establishes sort of minimum thresholds and your objectives. Then this will start to be placed into context. You're right, it's coming sort of early, it'll be placed into context. I think what's happening here, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that you are sort of framing this up as a process that you would undertake to develop a draft rule, and that it would be refined over time, and it's running in parallel. This information is going to have to intersect with this. And like so many of the things that we'll be doing, it will be somewhat iterative, right? We'll come back, like what we just had a discussion today about. The protocols are the how, but we got to get to the where, and then we'll see these different things start to come together. So I think right now it's bigger picture. But you're right, you don't have all the information you need yet to make these determinations. Please let me know if that's not entirely correct.
That's true. And none of this is lending any support one way or the other on any of these activities. This is what we've heard going on. People are still maybe working on these. These might be framing offices. You know, I've put specifics in, hypothetical, you know, you can take it out, but these circumstances or others that could run into situations where control of the basin is changed. You know, people may lose rights or other things that we need to be aware of so the agency can step in and regulate that accordingly. So some of this is really just trying to stay ahead of where others may come to the table so the agency can set the ground rules for what's acceptable and not acceptable in this basin.
Joshua?
Yeah, no. Oh, go ahead.
Two comments. the ability to bring water down from paradise, I'm not saying it's going to be paradise's water, it can be a Butte County entitlement water, I think is something that's very good for this area to help with future water levels in the valley. Secondly, on issue three, you have down here that the proposed Tuscan Water District has projects in mind. We do not. It's just that if we were a water district, we could help facilitate projects throughout the county. There's no projects in mind, so I just want to clarify that.
It's like putting in the conditional.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. As a united front, then, we could do projects that would be good for everybody here in the valley. But there are no projects, and that's something everybody says, there's all these projects we have. We don't. So, I just want to clarify that.
Yeah, so to ensure that that's clarified.
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
just to additional contextual stuff maybe is redundant information, because I understand your concern. Why would you be taking water from PID from the lake, which ultimately will end up down here anyway, unless it's being used in Paradise for domestic uses. So it is still part of our aquashed and becomes part of our groundwater in some way or another, or remains as surface water. Otherwise, it's used in Paradise. Is really a timing issue that is opportunistic, as opposed to, well, let's look at that in 3 years from now. Paradise Irrigation District will be insolvent in 3 years. So that the opportunity, they've lost 90% of their customer base, and they're an independent water district. So if they don't find a way to utilize that water to generate some revenues in a way that's productive, I mean, the estimates, I'm involved in the Paradise reconstruction efforts, the estimates for how many people will come back to the area and what that's going to look like post-recovery are significant. If you look at them historically from a disaster recovery standpoint, are very low. The upper end estimates over the next decade are 30% of its original population. And so if you look at trying to create a viable, and I'm not promoting it, I'm just sharing the information that was shared with me. If you look at trying to promote some level of sustainability so that PID doesn't become a non-independent entity and get taken over by somebody else, this was one of the ways that they looked at it. Now, I think you brought up some good points. How long is it good for? Who ultimately owns the water? Can it be exported out? Is there a sunset on it so that if reconstruction does happen and PID becomes independently sustainable again, that they can then divert that water back? Those are, I think, are all good topics, but just sharing a little additional context. But
I'm going to suggest, Lance, to what you said, I can't imagine having 10,000 customers, and I got up that morning, parked my car in the street and looked south of town, and there was this huge cloud. Went in, turned on the news. I can't imagine that morning having 10,000 customers and that night having 700. But, again, it's just a thought, because I'm not in your shoes. You didn't lose 10,000 customers. You lost demand for 10,000 properties. And I've talked to a few people that I know that own property up there, and I told them, and I don't own anything up there, but if it was me, and I divided the numbers out as to what it cost, just based on what I've heard at meetings, and it sounded like, I'm going to say $58.33 a customer. If I own a piece of property up there, and I've also heard that some people are paying $20 an hour, and I don't know the details, but I have pushed with what few people I know that if I own property up there, I would be trying to get all of those people to kick in, because what I think, and this is off the track from the GSA, but it is PID, if you own a lot up there and it's worth, let's just say, $50,000 now, but if you lose the water supply, it may be worth nothing. I own property in Chico. If I don't, which is why I'm here, if I don't have the water supply, my property is worth nothing. It would be, and I have a friend who has $500,000 sitting in the bank now on their lot. I wouldn't give it a second thought to kick in $60 a month to keep PID afloat.
So Bruce, because we're out of time, I'm just going to ask you, Paul, to tell us maybe what you think is next.
And I think with Greg's comments, and I think getting off track, pros and merits of the PID intertie, which is not relevant at all to this. I'm going to change these specific topics to more general pointed topics. The point is, you know, municipal industrial water supplier in the Vina sub-basin gets a surface water supply. Who cares where it comes from? They get it. What does this change those questions? What does it do to them? Same thing with an ag district shows up in the Vina sub-basin. They don't have farm rights. They get some water. What does that do to groundwater rights holders? What does it do to rights? So I think generalizing, even though we heard specific projects come out, I think for this analysis and I think for the agencies, just generalizing scenarios without getting too specific, because people are going to get into the merits of this project, like it or not, or that project, and that isn't what this is about. This is about the circumstances where they could change groundwater recharge, and what does that constitute in terms of vulnerabilities to the basin. If that'll help, because none of this is about these specific projects per se, but they illustrate some things that we do need to analyze to protect the basin. And so.
Yes, to the
yes. It seems to me, based upon the discussion of the limits of the data and the time frame needed to improve it, that it's going to take time, obviously. But the things that's pushing this, it seems to me, is that the Board of Supervisors and LAFCO are going to be asked very shortly to make some decisions. And I'm wondering if this group and the department is going to make a recommendation based upon the facts. My own experience with this kind of plan, which was mostly in healthcare systems, a lot of unknowns there too, is that when you don't know the answer right away and you have to make one, politics and personal opinion win the day. That sounds like a pretty scary proposition to a guy who already pays 70 bucks a month for water here in Chico on a house that's got, you know, a good landscaping system.
Yeah, and again, this process is not going to get into any merits or whatever, any project per se. It's about the legalities of different types of water projects. Hypothetically, in a legal analysis, that will be, you know, pretty straightforward, and then what vulnerabilities we have to advise the Biden GSA board on that rule. So it can be targeted, there might be other things the board needs to do to be protective. So this is not going to get into any specific projects, pros or opposition to it. It's going to be, you know, what the Biden GSA board needs to do to protect the basin from other circumstances that could present some vulnerabilities.
So Paul, let me ask you a question because we really do need to wrap it up.
I know, but I really need to come on that time.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Yes, let me just talk about the process and then I'm going to come back to you. So I just want to, because this might help, Jim. So do you intend to just make those changes and bring it back for further discussion and then we can create more time? What are your thoughts?
No, I mean, my question to this group and the feedback was other circumstances, other vulnerabilities you want us to take a look at, you know, to evaluate. And it might be that once this gets done, Valerie and team will start doing the work, drafts are going to come out, you know, for people to take a look at, some discussion. It's obviously going to go to the management committee that's going to help drive the rules. So this is not going to be something that will be done, you know, in the next few weeks. There will be some discussion, presentation, that we can all get feedback on. If there's things that are missed before we get to the board that would need to be protected, we want to make sure we capture everything.
Right. So that's what I'm saying, that it seems like we need a little more time for this discussion, and we really need to honor time of these meetings that we've gone over. And so I'm just wondering, is it possible to bring it back?
We can bring it back. We can bring it back, but I've been patient.
Yes, you have.
One, the title of this, around rules for out-of-basin transfer rule, that's not the main issue. Gary's got the main issue. What happens to overlying landowners? I don't know why this is not an out-of-basin transfer rule. We've got to be in the area if we're going to look over this. I don't like the title.
Okay.
Two, the momentum of artificial recharge, unproven, no science-based analysis of the efficacy. Or what's going to happen when adjacent downslope aquifer users are tapping the system?
Okay.
Why are we recharging water when GSA's going to suck it out if that's what's going to happen possible? I don't understand why there's so much momentum behind artificial recharge when other strategies, proven strategies of conservation, water recycling, land use policies that prevents early sprawl, that prevents irrigated agriculture sprawl.
Okay.
These are the issues.
Let's identify other issues.
The momentum for artificial recharge is being pushed hard by Butte County for the past couple of years, and I'm very concerned about that.
Okay, I've captured that. Are there others that you wanted to mention? Because it's important for Paul to take that into consideration.
Good.
For our next discussion. For your, any
I'm happy
to regulate out-of-basin dams.
Well, the board is not aware of the legal implications of overriding dams and the concerns of people that are following this. What they are aware of is out-of-basin transfers. So I would like to see the consequences of artificial recharge as a title rather than out-of-basin transfers, because that is, as far as the people in this room, I don't think that is the issue.
Yeah, I agree. The title is talking about the end product. The purpose is kind of what you're talking about, the consequences of artificial recharge
and
product.
And the consequences are laid out quite nicely in this document. And they don't have anything to do with out-of-basin transfers necessarily.
Okay. The purpose needs to be clear, and the title should reflect the purpose, is what I'm getting from what you said. I thank you, and thank you for your patience on this. And I'm sorry to keep you over. We'll try to do better with that. Thank you. We will put together meeting notes, get those out to you. We will post all of the things that we said we would post. And then please make note that our next meeting is going to be March 17th, same time, same place. I imagine it will be from 9 to noon. We're going to have loaded agendas, I think.
I would love that if we could make ourselves 7 minutes on meetings, because we become unproductive in all of us after 2 hours. You know, it really goes downhill.
Yeah, we need to end on time. That's my job.